Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Another week and good guests on vital topics. Today, the topic is one we return to all the time. Israel-Palestine, and a regular on this program, Ramzi Baroud. Ramzi will be on. He's a veteran Palestinian-American journalist, a former Al Jazeera producer. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of Palestine Chronicle. It's about the best website I know for information on Israel-Palestine. Very easy to find. Simply Google Palestine Chronicle. It's the way I bring it up, the easy way for me. Ramzi's written many, many articles, commentaries. He writes short stories. He's authored several books. And with Palestinians calling for a third intifada, oh, is it ever needed? His newest book is very relevant. It's called The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle. So much to talk about because this story just goes on day after day. Ramzi, I hope we're connected.
I am here, Steve. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, welcome, Ramzi. Well, you're a very important person for me, and I can't think of anybody who I'd rather have on to discuss this. But there are many good people, as we both know, such wonderful people who can discuss this vital, vital issue. Your latest article, which I read after I began working on my own, addresses really the same topic, the idea of investigating Israel's war crimes in the recent Gaza conflict. I sent you one this morning, and I'll send you this one midweek, probably on Wednesday. It's a follow-up to my first one, where I just went through the indicting evidence, and this one goes through the need to investigate the crimes, and of course now the UN Human Rights Council appointed Richard Goldstone, and I've got my fingers crossed that he'll do the kind of job that we both hope he will.
I hope so, yeah.
I asked one person I have some respect for what he thought of Goldstone and what he would do, and he was rather positive, so hopefully something will come, at least in a good outcome, Ramzi. I think we both know the way Israel will receive it. They pretty much trashed him and others in the past, so they will this time. And they conducted their own 11-day investigation, quote-unquote investigation. And, of course, they always turn out the same way. They whitewash it.
Exactly. That has been consistent, I think, with Israeli history. The whole idea that Israel actually has the right to investigate war crimes that were ordered by the Israeli government itself. The whole thing doesn't really make any sense, but the sad reality is that in the U.S. here, we treat the investigations as very serious legal endeavors. And if the investigations yield even the slightest rebuke of Israeli soldiers, our officials here in Washington, they will deal with the issue as yet another proof of Israel's moral superiority and the fact that they are a democracy and a country of law and so forth and so on. And we forget the fact that the investigation was of no relevance at all to the outcome. Nobody gets punished.
Oh, indeed, Ramzi.
Those who get punished by Israeli investigations.
Ramzi, that music means we need to take a break. Let's do that, and we'll be right back, and we'll continue.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm on with Ramzi Baroud. We're talking about Israel-Palestine and the December-January Gaza War. Operation Cast Lead is the name that Israel gave to it. Ramzi, Israel investigates its war crimes the way the Pentagon investigates is it's they do it the same way. They go through a pro forma, whatever. They really end up doing absolutely nothing whatsoever. They just pretend that they're doing something. And invariably, they always come up with the same conclusion that there simply is no evidence to justify the claim that we did anything out of the ordinary. And if by chance we killed or wounded some civilians, it was only an unfortunate accident. We didn't really mean to do that. You know, when there's war going on, then innocent people occasionally get hurt, but these aren't war crimes. These are the typical kind of answers. And this time, the Israeli judge advocate general dismissed clear-cut, incontrovertible evidence from Israeli soldiers who came forward on their own. They didn't have to do it. They came forward on their own, and they admitted what commanders ordered them to do, shoot civilians in cold blood. And the judge advocate general said, well, this is just hearsay. I mean, it really is outrageous that
it really is, Steve. But I still think that there is a detectable difference between U.S. investigations, Pentagon investigations, and Israeli investigations, in the sense that U.S. investigations, like the one that followed the human rights violations in Abu Ghraib, there was admission that what happened in Abu Ghraib were human rights violations.
There was a reason for that, Ramsey. The reason was that it exploded to such an extent that it made headlines on television here in the U.S.
But I guess what I mean is that the fact that they have visual evidence of the war crime made them realize that they are in a crisis, and they went to crisis management mode. Of course, the big shots, nobody was prosecuted.
Exactly.
It's the low-ranking officers who paid the price, which is typical Pentagon investigation.
Oh, indeed.
In the Israeli case, you have the visual evidence. It's on YouTube, for crying out loud. We watched it on Al Jazeera 24/7. We know the numbers. We know the evidence. We spoke to the people. UN observers were there. They all had, documented every single thing. But not only that, as you stated, even Israeli soldiers described in details how they shot women and their children, and how they laughed and jeered and had a ball killing people in Gaza. And yet, Israel would investigate and would come up with the result that our army is the most moral army in the world, and there were no human rights violations in Gaza. In fact, in some incidents, like what happened in Hebron in 2001, I believe, Israeli settlers killed a 10-year-old boy. They smashed his head with a boulder in the first few months of the second intifada. Israel investigated, and they indicted the settler for the first time in many years. He was indicted. And guess what? They fined him 1 agora. That's less than a penny. So it was an investigation. They found out that the settler was committed a crime, and he was he was forced to pay a penny. As if the idea is to say the life of a Palestinian boy is so worthless, it's equal a penny. So we admit of the crime, we admit of the murder, and he is going to pay the equal price of his crime, and that is less than one penny. So I think Israeli investigations are much more insulting. They reflect that sense of moral superiority that our victims are worthless and they do not matter.
Well, Ramsey, I agree with you. I think among all the nominal democracies in the world, Israel absolutely ranks on the bottom of doing anything to do an investigation of this type and to come up with even a hint of an honest assessment of what in fact really happened. So they absolutely rank on the bottom. But what goes on in an out-and-out despotic state? In Nazi Germany, they did what they wanted to do, and nobody made any investigations, and nobody made any excuses. So it's a different kind of system. But in nominal democracies, I do not call Israel a democracy. I don't call America a democracy. It's simply, nominally, it's that way. but in fact it operates in a much different way. So we do what we please. Israel does what it pleases. But you're absolutely right. They really are rock bottom in terms of doing anything to establish justice. And even the Supreme Court can make decisions that says it's okay to torture people if you say it's a ticking time bomb situation. Well, a ticking time bomb can be anything that anybody says it is. It could be an innocent person rounded up by mistake, called a ticking time bomb, a hideous phrase, and you've got the right to torture him. Well, the Israeli Supreme Court said so, so it has to be right. I can't even imagine our Supreme Court making a decision like that, Ramsey.
Exactly. So I do think that there are boundaries, and I think drawing similarities between the regime in Tel Aviv and other regimes that operate under the guise of democracy, I think it's poignant and important, but I also think it's equally important to kind of create distinctions. Because Israel, like the whole idea of security in Israel, when Israel says security, and when the U.S. says security, I think that these are two different concepts. Because in the U.S., for example, or in any other European countries, the term security refers to specific concepts, such as preventing harm and violence from taking place. In Israel, security is entitlement. It's national entitlement. It's an obsession. It means that not only Palestinians are a security threat in their mere existence, but the fact that they are augmenting in numbers, the fact that their birth rate is higher than that of Israel, is also a security threat to Israel. So what can Palestinians do to lower Israel's anxiety from security? You see what I mean? So you have all these terminologies that are used quite actively in Israel. Security, peace, democracy. All of these terminologies would have to be qualified. They don't really mean what we think they mean. We have to understand them within the Israeli context to decipher the true meaning of these terms.
Oh, absolutely. They use the right language. They're very effective at what they do, what they say. But it's all a big cover-up to justify the most unjustifiable acts. And, of course, when we talk about Palestinians, Ramsey, we have to distinguish between Palestinians in the territories, Gaza and the West Bank, and a million and a half, if I got the right number, a million and a half Israeli citizens, 20% of the state of Israel, Israeli citizens who really, in any democratic state, should have the same rights as any other citizen. But Israel isn't structured that way. Israel calls itself a Jewish state, and only Jews get the rights that the law allows. No one else. With Arabs, Muslim people, absolutely on the bottom, but not even Christians. Christians aren't treated equally to Jews. What kind of a democracy is this?
Exactly, and that's the question. What kind of a democracy is this? Now, the sad reality is that our Congress think that Israel's democracy is one of a kind, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. The media wants to convince us that Israeli democracy is superior to all forms of democracy. Well, the reality is what's going on in Israel is anything but a democracy. It's ethnic democracy at best. The 1.5 million Palestinians who are Israeli citizens are not just treated like second-class citizens. They are actually under the constant threat of being expelled from the country. In fact, Avigdor Lieberman, the new Israeli foreign minister, won the election based on his threat that he is going to rid Israel of its Arab problem, meaning to deport and expel the 1.5 million Arabs living there. You would think, well, this is a fascist politician, right? Well, not exactly. Even Tzipi Livni, she made that very clear in a recent lecture she had at some university in Israel, where she said that the existence of those Arabs in Israel poses a problem and their loyalty is somewhere else, and that's why they have to be removed somewhere else. This is mainstream politics in Israel. So, in America, minorities have certain grievances. Women have certain grievances. Racial minorities have certain grievances. They demand equality, and they are not treated as equal. In Israel, the problem is not just equality. It's your mere existence in the land is the problem.
Right.
Everybody is saying that you are a demographic threat and you have to be dumped somewhere else. So
absolutely.
That's the fear that Palestinians have.
It's astonishing, Ramsey, that 20% of Israel's population is treated, in Israel's terminology, as a fifth column, it's a terrorist segment of the population that has to be dealt with in that context. I mean, these are ordinary people, just like the Jewish population, but they're not treated that way. And again, I mean, it's absolutely appalling that the people should be treated this way. The demography bomb, or the demographic bomb that Israel sees, again, as you say, a faster-growing Palestinian population that will overtake the Jewish population, and this is a great threat, so you have to deal with it by getting rid of these people, putting up all kinds of barriers, all kinds of restrictions, all kinds of things to assure a majority Jewish population. So all of these things go on all the time, and Palestinian people suffer so grievously as a result. Another break, Ramsey. Let's take it, and we'll come back and continue this story.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. I'm on with Ramsey Baroud. We're talking about Israel-Palestine, the last Gaza war that ended after 22 days. About the 18th, 19th of January, the weeks and months go by so fast. Ramsey, in my writing, I like to quote international law quite often. I think it's so important. I mean, these laws are so sacred. So much went into creating these laws. Good people put this together, and so many of them came out after World War II, the war that was so horrific that people really said, I guess in crafting this, that we just need to put together a framework to see that this just doesn't happen again. Well, I don't think anybody believed it wouldn't happen again, but at least put up things that would be restraints against the worst of crimes being committed. Of course, the worst one of all is to go to war in the first place, but then to commit all of these grievous acts that go on. Combatants seem to have no rules. They just do whatever they please. But you've got the four Geneva Conventions. You've got the conventions against torture. You've got all kinds of laws that are on the books. And I don't know what the law in Israel is precisely on this, but when the U.S. signs a treaty, there's something in our Constitution here called the Supremacy Clause. And that simply means that every treaty the U.S. signs automatically becomes U.S. law. Well, we break the law just the way Israel does. We sign these treaties. The law is the law. And then we just do what we please and forget about the law. And Israel flouts it all the time. Those dozens of UN resolutions, when some were actually passed, Ramsey, now the U.S. just vetoes everything automatically. It doesn't, lets nothing get through that in any way can harm Israel. The General Assembly is another matter, but it doesn't have to bite the teeth that the Security Council has. But there were so many UN resolutions passed that basically lay down the law to Israel, and Israel just forgets about it. Absolutely does nothing. It gets away with it, mainly because Washington backs whatever it wants to do, and all the Western states pretty much go along, and even most Arab states go along. So Israel gets carte blanche to do what it pleases. One note I mentioned last week with a guest, I'll mention it briefly, then you continue, Ramsey. In my last article that I went into Zionism, defending the indefensible, at the end you may remember, I quoted a CIA study that predicted in the next 15 years 2 million Israeli Jews will leave the country and come to America. Well, the reason has to be because they're fed up and they just want to get away from it. But even more than that, These have to be the very people Israel does not want to lose. So if that happens, that is mighty, mighty serious stuff. I don't know what Israel is doing to avoid that. There's a very simple answer, Ramsey, we both know. Just stop doing these outrageous things they're doing and act like a normal country, and everything will settle down and it'll be fine. But they won't do that.
You know, I first of all, I mean, to go back to the issue of the laws, I think I think Israel has a way and a system of dealing with these laws. And that system has proved to be successful to a high degree for many years. First of all, no law would pass from the Security Council that is obligatory of Israel in any way that does not get vetoed by the U.S. So the U.S. Vetoed numerous resolutions that would shield Israel from any accountability. Most of the resolutions that passed by the General Assembly, and as we know, the General Assembly is really there for moral validation of the United Nations. The executive powers all lie in the Security Council. But let's say that in fact, the U.S. found itself in one particular point in history under extreme pressure to allow for a certain law that calls on Israel to do 1, 2, 3. Well, Israel is not going to do it because there is absolutely nothing there, no mechanism whatsoever to enforce that law. I reported from the Security Council for a few months in 2000 and 2001, and I remember it clearly how the Israelis, you know, the entire international community will be debating, will be discussing certain things, and the U.S. will be dealing with a lot of pressure coming from all over the place. And the Israeli ambassador wouldn't even bother come to press conferences, wouldn't even bother deal with the issue because they know very well that they are going to get away with it, and because there is absolutely no one out there who is going to enforce anything on Israel. Now compare this to Iraq, compare this to Sudan. Israel right now, they complain that this UN investigation that is being carried out right now by Richard Goldstone is unfair, and it's another opportunity for, you know, Israeli bashers to bash Israel, and so forth and so on. You know, the same typical censure. But the fact is, this is not unfair, and this is not singling Israel out, because we saw the same thing happening in Yugoslavia, we saw the same thing happening in Sudan and other places. Other countries are treated based on a double standard. If you are a Sudani or if you are an Iraqi, you better watch out. Because there will be laws, and these laws will be interpreted in the way that would fit the interests of superpowers, and you will ultimately pay the price. In Israel, that doesn't happen, and yet Israel still complains that they are being treated based on a double standard.
Oh, that is absolutely right, Ramsey. Again, they get away with it because nobody holds them to account. They basically say what they want to say. They make their case. There's no refutation. The media here is one great example. My goodness, you just don't hear critical reports in our media about Israel, no matter what it does. We need to take another break. Let's do that, and then we've got the second half of the program and only one break in it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. I'm Mahmoud Ramsey Baru, talking about Israel-Palestine, the Gaza War. Ramsey, I think what people also need to remember is we had 22 horrific days, but preceding them and following them, Israel targets Palestinians, including in the West Bank, virtually on a daily basis. In Gaza, there have been numerous bombings, attacks. After the Gaza War, the fighting ended in mid-January or so. There have been numerous raids, bombings, killings, incursions. Israel, again, does what it pleases. The one thing, and of course in the West Bank, a completely locked down, completely under military occupation, a very oppressive existence, and raids go on. in communities and neighborhoods. People's homes are burst into, arrests are made. No idea. The people have no idea what they're being held to account for, but they're taken away, including children, young kids, teenagers, maybe even younger at times. Who knows? And, I mean, this is police state stuff. This is the worst kind of police state stuff. And it literally goes on every day of the week. At the same time, Gaza struck a nerve, Ramsey. Gaza really struck a nerve. What Israel did was so extreme over those 22 days. It's done worse in the past. Nothing compares to 1947, 1948. And, of course, the Lebanon, the first Lebanon war in 1982, killing about 18,000 people, and the terrible massacres at Sabra and Shatila. But these 22 days really struck a nerve enough to get mass protests, I mean really mass protests around the world, people really angry about this, and it really gave a shot of adrenaline to the global BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, and independent organizations have conducted their own investigations from Human Rights Watch, which is far from the best source, but even they were condemning. Amnesty International called for a boycott, an arms boycott, embargo, whatever term they used, against Israel. Physicians for Human Rights conducted an investigation. Palestinian human rights organizations conducting their own investigations, but numerous ones done. The conclusions are all the same. The evidence is all the same. There can be some minor differences around the edges in what people come up with, but basically Gaza was just leveled. I mean, many, many hundreds of buildings, civilian building structures destroyed, 5,000 people injured, 1,400 or so killed. I mean, this was just terrible stuff that went on. So maybe, this is an opening to get somebody, some effective body, starting with, say, a UN investigation, moving to a criminal court, maybe something like the Spanish court, possible, and people really being held to account, and something coming out of this. I have to say the odds are long, Ramsey, but I think they're better than we've seen before. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I think you're right, Steve. I think there is an opening, but I think that even that opening would have to be put within a context. What Israel has done in Gaza, of course, Israel has its own logic, as twisted as it is. But from the point of view of the rest of the world, what happened in Gaza was unprecedented in the history of this conflict. In the past, you know, the numbers were always somewhere around one Israeli killed for 13 or 20 Israeli, 20 Palestinians killed. The ratio has changed so dramatically in Gaza to the point it was one Israeli killed or wounded for 1,000 Palestinian killed or wounded. That ratio is so outrageously high, and Israel's insistent justifications that this is all about security, this is all about ridding ourselves from terror and so forth and so on, did not sell very well. You do not destroy 20,000 homes by saying, I'm eradicating the infrastructure of terror. I think people are, you know, unless they are indoctrinated, I think most people would not accept this. And again, you don't need Richard Goldstone or Richard Falk or anybody to investigate and to tell you this is a war crime. You don't need to refer to the Geneva Convention to know that this is that's what happened in Gaza, were war crimes. Again, go to YouTube and you will find out that there were war crimes. But the question is, what do we do with all of this awareness, with all these new realizations, with all these new understandings of what's happening in Gaza? I think the boycott movement is one of the most effective things that civil society can undertake. The legal system is one other issue, because we have the U.S., you have veto powers, you have pressures. We know that there's a lot of pressure on Spain to alter its own laws just for the sake of Israel. In fact, I think that there has already been much done to ensure that Israelis will not be tried in Spain. We know that the U.S. still, despite of all these crises that they are undergoing, they still have the leverage to exact that sort of pressure, the same way they did in Belgium when they tried to try Ariel Sharon a few years back. But what we can do as civil society is what really matters, because nobody has any sort of leverage over us to how we shop, how we behave as individuals, what do we buy, what we don't buy. So I think that as a civil society, this is the most powerful and effective things we can do. I think people need to go to the internet and they need to learn about the boycott and sanctions and divestment movement out there. It's very powerful and it's very effective and it's gaining momentum. In fact, in recent reports in Israel, in Israeli media and European media, they are talking that Israeli businesses are you know, businesses, of course, that have benefited the occupation one way or the other, have been suffering in many countries in Europe, in Norway, in France, in Spain, and elsewhere. They are paying, even in Britain itself, they are paying the price of supporting an army that's committing war crimes against defenseless civilians. We need to activate that in the United States. We need this country to, at least the civil society in this country, to play the same role they played during the South African apartheid years. That the moral stances we took in this country on those years, they would have to be repeated again, because Gaza, South Africa, any oppression anywhere is an oppression everywhere. We have to keep that in mind as well.
Oh, indeed. To get momentum on South Africa, Ramsey, it took many years of really whitewashing that and doing nothing. South Africa was an ally. We simply didn't care about black people there or any place else. But finally, it came to a head. Enough people got behind it, and the impossible happened. An ugly system was ended, the apartheid system. And South Africans who visit the occupied territories say what's going on there is far worse than anything that ever happened in South Africa. I mean, my God, the territories are under military occupation. South Africa wasn't under military occupation. People, the black people, were treated abysmally. But they had more rights there than Palestinians do in occupied Palestine. So things take time. It's very tough going up against an established regime that has world support, no matter what it does. And it takes momentum, building on momentum, to just add it a little at a time, a little at a time. And eventually things can happen. I honestly believe, you and I have talked about this before, I honestly believe that somewhere out there is Israel's day of reckoning. They cannot get away with this forever, and they won't. They won't. But how long does it have to go on? How many people have to suffer, die, go through what they're going through now? Just the Gaza siege alone, Ramsey. I don't think 1 in 100 Americans have any idea what the people of Gaza have gone through for over a year and a half. I think it's getting close to 2 years now with Gaza under siege. Where virtually everything beyond minimal necessities have gotten in, too little to really satisfy basic needs. And Israel has kept essential stuff out, enough medical care, enough food of the right kinds, enough power so that bakeries can operate to bake bread. There isn't enough. And, of course, during the Gaza conflict, like all power, virtually all power was lost. The one power plant in Gaza had to shut down. There was no fuel. But, of course, Israel can bomb all of this stuff and just put it out of commission. And they put so much out of commission. This is their tactic when they go to war. They target the civilian population, the civilian infrastructure. It has nothing to do with a military objective. It's completely illegal. They do it and they get away with it. Well, they have to be held to account at some point. And this has to stop. I think it'll happen, Ramsey. I hope I will live long enough to see it. I think you will. I hope I do.
Thank you, Steve. I do think it's going to happen as well. But one thing we know for sure, you see, there are few things that we can say or predict in this life. We don't know. We know it's going to happen. History has ways of repeating itself. Nobody stays on top forever. Nobody is superior forever. We know that. We understand that from the history of empires, big and small. So we know that. But what we know for sure is that, and we know that it will always be the case, is that Palestinians are not going to give in. They are going to resist, and they are going to carry on. It was Israel. What Israel hoped to achieve in Gaza is that chaos would reign, and then the people would just, all of them, millions, go to the street, and they would burn buildings and overthrow governments, but none of this happened. This is hours after the declaration of the ceasefire. Gaza was running in a perfect order. 20% of Gaza was destroyed. Yet somehow people went to the streets and they tried to resume a level of normality in their lives. Gaza is used to this. As sad and tragic as this may sound, Gaza is used to suffering, and Gaza is used to withstanding suffering. Gazans are used to, we joke amongst ourselves as Palestinians that, whatever happens in the world, a Y2K bug or a economic meltdown or whatever, Gaza most likely it will be the last standing place on earth. Because they are just good at surviving under the harshest of circumstances. I know it's no joking matter, but that is the reality. I just finished the rough draft of a book I wrote about the history of Gaza called Gaza, the Untold Story. And frankly, Steve, as I'm writing the book, I'm realizing things that I did not realize before. I mean, we talk about history of suffering, 6 decades, 60 years of Palestinians enduring. But to actually see it in its very raw details, to see how generation after generation, Palestinians are holding on the same commitment, behaving in the same way under the harshest circumstances, whether 1948, 1956, 1967, before, after, it's all the same. They are there, they always go to the street, they always march, they always express their anger, and they always express their unity and solidarity. It's just amazing. And I know that the same thing, the same pattern is going to carry on until one day Palestine is free.
Oh, indeed, Ramsey. It's an incredible story. After over 60 years since 1947-48 and 42 years of occupation, the resiliency of the people is really remarkable. And let me say to listeners, I've mentioned this before, but I'll remind people who don't remember, from what you speak, you were born in a Gaza refugee camp. So you know from your personal experiences going back then just what goes on and how resilient people are. And they endure no matter what happens. It really is a wonderful story. Ramsey, if Gazans or occupied Palestinians were Jews instead of Palestinians, Hollywood would make a magnificent movie out of this, and the theme would be this survival, this resilience. It would be a wonderful story. It would be well publicized. A lot of people will go to see it, and would learn about these brave people putting it up against this harsh occupier, which would be not Jews, but someone else, which is the way the Jews were treated in Nazi Germany. It's been a story, the way Jews are now portrayed for what they have gone through. We build this history. In this case, they build a history that blows it way out of context, way out of proportion to many things that happened. I don't minimize the Holocaust at all, whatever the true numbers were, but all the fact that Jews have been long suffering for many, many eons, centuries in Eastern Europe and so on, but so have another people. There's nothing unique about Jewish suffering. It's the same story that's repeated. You could, for Palestinians, for Kurdish people, for people throughout Africa, for people throughout Latin America, for people throughout Asia, and for so many right here in America. I like to say, Ramsey, that I live about a mile or so from people who live in deep poverty in a modern city like Chicago, and these people, many times they go to bed hungry at night because they don't have enough money to buy enough food to eat. In Chicago? Well, my goodness, if it happens in Chicago, what do you think goes on in occupied Palestine? Under siege? In Gaza? How many people think like this? How many people realize? And none of this needs to happen. All of this is avoidable. It's very simple. If governments acted responsibly, if people with the power cared about things like this, but they don't, and too often their feelings are exactly the opposite. They want to inflict this stuff for their own personal gains. It what motivates me to keep what I'm doing, Ramsey. I simply can't stand it, and it makes me want to write about it and talk about it on this program, whether it's about Palestinians or anybody else who's persecuted. You know, political prisoners is a big issue for me. I simply can't stand the fact that innocent people are treated to injustice. To me, this is a terrible, terrible crime. Some of the best people are called criminals and put away for long years, and the absolute worst people are allowed to get away with the worst crimes.
Absolutely, Steve. The human suffering manifests itself in so many different ways, and what's going on in Gaza is but an extreme manifestation of that. But I don't think anybody should hold any sense of entitlement, any sense of ownership over suffering. In fact, I think the suffering of Gaza is a continuation of the suffering that happened to so many people, including the Jewish people, during the Holocaust and World War II. We need to realize that in order for us to learn and glean lessons from the horrible crimes in World War II, as opposed to just draw a circle over specific suffering, you know, and refuse to juxtapose it with any other. That is just not fair. It's just simply irrational. But I also think every episode of suffering has its own uniqueness. What I mean is, in Gaza, for example, it's not a typical story of suffering, meaning that there is a superior power that's inflicting much harm on a native population. I think there's another twist, and that is the fact that Gaza is yet to fall puts a new twist on the story. I know that there is a commercial, so we'll finish when we come back.
Oh, yeah, let's take that break, Ramsey. We will be right back for a final short segment.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back. A final segment with Ramsey Baroud. Ramsey, let me just mention again your website, Palestine Chronicle. Is it ORG? I forget, because I always just Google Palestine Chronicle.
It's PalestineChronicle.com.
.com. Okay, yeah. Palestine
and
Chronicle.
And the good news is that we are finally on the first page of Google under Palestine. It took us years to reach this level, so you can just Google Palestine and we'll be there.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is absolutely wonderful. Well, it's amazing. I mean, you really do have the best website on Occupied Palestine and more. I mean, you cover more topics as well, but you focus so heavily on that, as you should.
We try to link the struggle in Palestine to struggles elsewhere, Steve. We think it's very important that we make that clear.
Oh, indeed, indeed. And then let me just mention your most recent book, and I want to ask you a question about the new one. The one that is easily found on Amazon, The Second Palestinian Intifada, A Chronicle of a People's Struggle. Oh, it's a wonderful book, Ramsey, but when is your new one coming out?
I just finished the new one, believe it or not, Steve, just yesterday.
Wonderful. Easter Sunday.
My father was a freedom fighter, Gaza, the Untold Story. It will be published by Pluto Press in digital format in 3 months, but in print by November of this year. The book is already being translated to French and Turkish. The first chapters are already being translated, and the movie rights of the book, because you were mentioning how Gaza would make a good story. Well, the movie rights have already been sold to a filmmaker in Canada.
Oh,
so
my
hopefully
goodness.
Something will come out of it.
So this will be a Canadian-made film?
In fact, there has already been a short film made about the original story behind the book that will be featured at Cannes Film Festival in a few weeks.
Oh, my goodness. Are you going?
I haven't yet been invited, but hopefully if the movie does well, maybe we'll do something.
Well, Ramsey, if Michael Moore could win an award for his last one, why not you?
You are too nice, Steve.
Oh, that is wonderful. You mean I have to wait until November to read your book? Oh, my goodness.
Absolutely not, Steve. I will send you a digital version of the book as soon as I can.
Let's talk about that. I would much rather have a hard copy of the book in my hand. A digital version?
Yes, because it will be published digitally first, because as you understand, the Gaza story is very pressing right now. And
oh, indeed.
So Bluetooth felt that it might be a good idea to release it in a digital format. So it will be purchased through Bluetooth website, but downloaded as a digital version.
Okay. I look forward to that.
Thank you.
I want to say something about it. I want to get you back to talk about it. Oh, all of this is so important, Ramsey. I don't have to tell you how important this is to me. I write about it all the time, not as often as you do, but quite often.
Oh, you do, and in fact, more often, Steve.
and a new one coming tomorrow. Barring the outbreak of World War III, then I'll have to say something about that. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But you finish up with some final thoughts.
My earlier thought about how the uniqueness of the Gaza story, as we know, Steve, it's irrational. It really is irrational what's going on in Gaza. That Israel is doing all of this, that the international community hasn't done anything to really stop Israel or to relieve the suffering of the besieged people of Gaza. But the story should have ended a long time ago with the first phosphorus bomb that fell on Gaza or the first napalm that was dropped on Gaza. But the fact is the Gaza story continues because the spirit of the people and the spirit of the struggle of the Palestinian people continues. And that's what makes the Gaza story unique. So I feel like there's so much to glean and learn from such story that to help us in our own struggles, whether on a personal, community, or a national struggle elsewhere around the world.
Oh, absolutely, Ramsey. I have to cut you off because they'll break away. But this is why we have to keep it alive, and I absolutely will do it on this program, including having you back to talk more about this. It won't end quickly. We will be back tomorrow. Ramsey, I thank you so much for coming on today. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll talk about the economy tomorrow. Join us then.